contribute his labor to. The union boss and the revolution, revolutionary syndicalism, the Communist Party, or maybe still a good Christian. Of course, there has always been others, and these points on the timeline are not all encompassing for numerous reasons. So, for instance, it took a long time for various migrant cultures to be assimilated into the Protestant work ethic. It's one of the main things that was going on at the time. And to clarify, this is a timeline of material developments, status quo ideologies, and the revolutionary responses to the former. Okay, so that's the Enlightenment. The next thing I want to talk about is the development of the consumer, which is founded upon the mass society that you need an industrial capacity to create, right? We don't get mass society without that sort of mass production. So, and I'm also considering that to be the modern period. Now we're moving on into the beginning of the postmodern. So after the two world wars of the 20th century, mass society doesn't disappear, but it does change, and that change profoundly impacts the way that man is considered, if at all, and the way that social life is thought of. One of the most significant changes in the late 20th century is the explosion of office work. If you look outside Humanist Hall that way, you should see at least a few skyscrapers. We have office work to thank for those skyscrapers. To paint the picture a little bit more, it's likely that you have a memory somewhere in your head of a video clip or a picture in black and white of crowds all wearing suits and hats. Anyone recall such images? Okay, so what you're actually imagining is the explosion of office workers, and this explosion with its skyscrapers and suits, it's symbolic of the city in so many different ways. And what this is a big part of is the beginning of man's end. Welcome to the 1950s. This really begins a few decades earlier, but the importance of the 1950s, roughly, is suburban expansion in relation to office work. So in other words, the dream of home ownership and a middle-class life. I'm focusing on the U.S. in this presentation, but similar things are happening elsewhere, for instance, in the U.K. Anyway, the point of this early to mid-20th century development is that it sets the stage for man to transition into the consumer. And as the divide between blue-collar and white-collar workers, the takeover of agriculture by big industry, and the idea of the suburban family becomes status quo, this trend of consumerism continues into the 60s and the 70s, roughly. Which is when another important shift occurs with Vietnam, the draft, civil rights, feminism, the counterculture, and new forms of social struggle making headlines. Not to mention the entertainment industry's boom and the stagnation of post-World War II benefits. So that's a time that I think has been drilled into our heads over and over. It's been romanticized, the 60s, especially for me. I'm a kid of a baby boomer generation, so I've had enough of that. It's also the new left and all that kind of thing. It's also when the situationists were proposing their ideas. But I think we can move on. So some thinkers divide the postmodern into two sections. The first part is what I just elaborated on. The second part is what I'm going to focus on now, which would be the digital age. And I'm corresponding this age with, instead of the consumer, the individual. And I'll explain why I'm doing this later. So the thing that begins to change, not only culturally, is that for a few decades out of this post-war mass society, the way people socialized was still very local. You had some capacity to communicate further distances with public transportation and automobiles, the mail system and telephones. But what had exploded was 60s and 70s counterculture. It settled down into a variety of subcultures, each with their own way of doing things. To emphasize what's happened here, the consumer society that was still massive began to let go of massiveness. The we are the world, give peace a chance, we're all against the establishment, man, kind of thing. With some bikers and shit. They were around, no doubt, and that was still very much orientated towards massiveness, even if it was a massive dissent. Alright? So, and as that massiveness waned, and as people began to become very involved in their subcultures, concepts of man and his status in the world made an escape through the back door. Alright. So, subcultures. Subcultures and subcultures and subcultures. For countercultural types, for suburban dads, for school kids, for television shows and magazines, and oh my fucking god, here comes the fucking internet. Here comes a network for instantaneous group socialization, far and wide. Here comes the digital age and its individual, free market loving, neoliberally grinning entrance onto the ground of a world where office and service work was ever more expansive, factories were being offshored, AOL Time Warner, Viacom, and the rest of the media conglomerate shit show was in its prime. A world where an altered globalization movement could fight neoliberalism, and what the fuck just happened? So about as quickly as subcultures grew, the media conglomerates, and eventually the internet, began to frustrate them and make them somewhat obsolete. A lot of this happened in the 90s, that's my youth, still inspired by earlier subcultures and a world where subcultural membership was an important part of growing up, yet compromised by MTV, Hot Topic, etc. Where new visibility came out of the internet, and yet the internet's growing popularity conflicted with the DIY localism of subcultures. And we know about the Battle of Seattle, right? Okay. And we know, and then, you know, the phrase from Profane Existence might seem a little passe at this point, making punk a threat again. I don't know if that'll ever happen again. So the individual by now has very much supplanted the subcultural, tribal sort of identities of my youth. I blame social media, but there's the rest of what I had just said as well. At least we can refer to social media for some evidence. So what is so different about today than the 90s, 80s, 60s, the great generation, and so on, is this way in which the consumer has transformed into a different sort of creature. Still a consumer, but the 21st century thing isn't subcultural membership and consumption, it's liking shit. Okay? It's being a fan of identity, defined by the variety of shit people can see that you're on your Facebook profile, your OKCupid profile, your LinkedIn profile, your YouTube channel, the pictures on your Instagram, and the smorgasbord of references on your clothing. So this is also how advertising has changed from branding according to subcultures into this more sophisticated sort of targeted marketing through social networks and data analysis. If you don't believe me about my research, because I kind of talk like a moron, I'll point you to one reference that's easy to take in, it's entertaining. It's Douglas Rushkoff's PBS documentaries, The Merchants of Cool, and one I'm more specifically referencing, The Like Generation. I don't want to say this is individualism and that the status quo is some sort of individualism. I'm not comfortable with that label. However, this sort of consumer isn't even as subcultural as a mall rat. And the world that they look forward to, the one that students and workers at Occupy encampments critique, and the world as it is post-9/11 inspired legislation and all the surveillance and regulation that gave us, well, that's significantly different than the world after the 60s. All right, I'm going to take a break for a second. That's my timeline that I'm working off of for the second part of this. The whole point is to observe... Someday I will
you'll write the books.
Write a zine for elementary school children. Okay, so that was the first part of my presentation. I wanted to lay out that timeline. Now this is the second part, and in the second part, I'm hoping that some of the things I mentioned in the first part will come to mind. This second part can be called something like an overview of anarchism's appeal. It's inspired by the disagreements that I see amongst comrades, the clashing of strategies and tactics, basically the clashing of the different worldviews that could be summed up as something like egoist, green anarchist, nihilist, anarchist communist and syndicalist, and insurrectionary anarchism. Now, I realize that there are histories for all these different schools, or what have you, but in relation to this timeline I laid out and how I'm framing the discussion, I'm focused more on the connection between worldview, historical period, and approach to anarchist activity that this variety of anarchist thinking brings to mind. The reason why I'm taking this angle is because corporations and the state have quite visibly shifted their strategies and tactics related to these changes. So what I'm going to introduce here is the notion of three different templates for what I'm calling appeal, and for strategy and tactics, or for ideological worldviews more generally. And I see these three templates playing out in contemporary anarchist discourse. This has probably been the case for quite some time, maybe since anarchism has been called anarchism. However, the popularity of each in the past has been more or less obvious according to this timeline, whereas now it seems to me like these three templates maybe get more of an equal hearing, or that together, in conflict, they're confusing. Those three templates are the mass, the subcultural, and the individual. I'll go over the history of each as briefly as I can, beginning with the mass, in accord with the timeline from part one. Just keep in mind that because I'm concentrating on one, it isn't to dismiss the existence of the others. Rather, it is to compare the status quo official narrative with their loyal opposition, so to speak. Popular things. Alright, so in that first part of the timeline that I'm calling the Enlightenment, you had the world wars, but what you had a lot of trade unions, you had syndicalism, you had state communism, mutualism, collectivist anarchism, and these all appealed to a mass-based template of how to relate to people and the way the world worked. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on the late 19th and early 20th century on Enlightenment-rooted anarchism or on the modern. I decidedly put more effort into this portion of the timeline to highlight the sort of world that classical anarchism was dealing with. But I suspect, at least I hope, that this is familiar territory to anybody here. So I'm going to provide you with a few choice terms for what I'm calling mass-based anarchism, what I think fits into the mass template. And as a spoiler, what I see a tendency to try and reproduce through slogans like the 99% versus the 1%, through the legions of Anonymous, and in a way even green anarchism, probably by accident because it appeals to a universal condition that is more like the universal working class conditions that earlier anarchists were appealing to. As far as, okay. So, in this period, there was the mutualist, collectivist, and communist, evident in Kropotkin's writings about fields and factories as one version of how this mass template functions. It also functions in the armed struggles of workers' movements. It functions in revolutionary and anarchist syndicalism. And for other revolutionaries, it certainly pops up with all the talk about what to do with the masses. And I'm talking about Marxists and Leninists. So that's one template, the mass template. It wanes with the historical development discussed in part one. So with what I'm introducing as sort of the postmodern time period around the 70s, you have more of a worker-student model of insurrection. You have attempts to reproduce mass movements through social justice sort of struggles. You have the waning of labor. You have the intervention into subcultures, info shops, and intentional communities. So what happened? during the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even the 90s and early 2000s is mostly over now. For anarchists, this is basically the resurgence period between the New Left and the Situationists playing out. It's the worker-student model of May 68 that defines some people's ideals for the 2000 student occupations. It's info shops, international communities, and subcultures. And of course, as there still are, there still were hangers-on to the mass template. This template is what I'm calling the subcultural, or perhaps better called the group template. It's still around, of course, affinity and discussions of like land projects and things like that sort of fall into this idea. But I hope to question it by the end of this. So there's a joke that you sometimes hear at a goth club, and you're probably not going to laugh because I'm explaining a joke instead of telling one. But it goes something like this. One person says, "Hey, did you see that person inside with the black hair?" And the other person says, "Which one?" And they respond, "The one wearing black with the dark makeup." And the other person says, "Which one?" You know, and by this point, people start laughing because you have to pay a lot more attention to the minor variations on goth themes to even refer to someone individually. So this sort of, some might call it uniformity, but this sort of production of subculture just isn't around as much as it had been in those past decades. A big part of a lot of people's social lives involved a rudimentary knowledge of subcultural symbolism, albeit most of this shit was confusing. But you knew a goth from a club kid, a raver, from a punk, from a new waver, a teeny bopper, from someone into gangster rap, from a mod, from a skinhead, from a Nazi skin if you were good at this. Urban spaces were divided up by subcultural territories. That's sort of still around, sort of. It's not vital knowledge for anybody anymore, and I'm specifically thinking about millennials and people that are going through high school now. There isn't much you can expect to know about somebody based on these things. So this kind of thing can be connected pretty well with what was happening in big cities at the time because there are very big changes to our shared experiences. This was a time when people were feeling extremely uncomfortable with mass society. And more importantly, they were finding ways to subvert or otherwise distance themselves from mass society through DIY techniques and media, fashion, lifestyle, to distribute used materials, living off the waste of mass production, touring around in automobiles, networking through the mail system and drop-ins or info shops. Above all, though, it took a while for corporations and politicians to figure out how to recuperate or otherwise win over all of these people that were adopting different perspectives of the world, ones that weren't status quo, that had their own autonomous discourse and lifestyles, and that revolutionaries and anarchists were coming out of. And if it helps, Think Crime Think's early writing about this kind of thing. So mostly disconnected from labor and its co-opted unions, pettily criminal, but dropouts and resistors. But that was all a countercultural thing, right? If you remember or can remember the status quo discourse, in so many ways it was about home ownership and consumption. It was an attempt to sell society on suburban expansion and an economy slowly moving away from production and embracing the predominance of office work. Well, that's been critiqued enough. You could find all about that at the bookstore. As for the academy, this is when we start to see Marxists and other sorts of humanists focus on intersectionality, which had plenty of subcultural groups to apply such an analysis to, right? You could get into arguments about the white middle class origins of punks and other dropouts, or the working class origins of skinheads, the origins of hip-hop in black inner city youth subculture, etc. The intersectional analysis, by which I mean an analysis of various forms of subcultural, of structural privilege as applied to individuals, you could take that analysis and use it in your day-to-day life to think about the way the pieces were falling. Why the old models of mass movements were ineffectual, why the same fights happened over and over again in those mass movements, and where to look for concrete sources of someone's opportunity in life. their housing situation, their job candidacy, their education opportunities, class, and other cultural expectations. You could estimate someone's receptivity to various political ideologies based on this sort of analysis and get results. That's sort of the point I'm getting at here with this entire presentation. And now you can't. And I'll discuss what has changed. So this part, I just got bored with my own writing and stopped writing. So I'm just going to be winging it from here. But the second part of what I'm calling the postmodern period is, like I said, it's about the digital age more than anything else. And some of the strategies and tactics that relate to this are flash mobs, the riot model of temporary autonomous zones. So you get the results by rioting. The occupation model, anonymous and hacktivism, digital media, regional and neighborhood semi-autonomous zones. So, as far as non-anarchists and non-revolutionaries, the way that corporations have been dealing with this digital age is to collect a lot of fucking data and target people based on who their friends are and based on what type of stuff they like. Or there's ubiquitous marketing where you just have your product everywhere and other things like that. So the idea of my discussion here is that there's a couple points I want to talk about, you know, like an actual discussion, like talk. And one of them is sort of like, what are the material and cultural limitations of something like Occupy? And also, what are some more individual or contemporary anarchist strategies and tactics that would relate to a time period more like the one we're living in? And if anybody has anything to say, I got more to say, but I'd like to hear. No one. All right, so what are some more, what are some of the more contemporary notions of struggle or strategy and tactics that you could think of that would fit a world that is individuated the way that it is now? Not so much a world where people are socializing into like lifestyle subcultural groups, but one where people are growing up and they're associating on this very broad networked medium that, for as broad as it is and for how inclusive it is, it also has a data capacity to be locked in your own bubble and to be individuated. Asking is, why does shit like that work? And why doesn't something like trying to start a new labor union work? Another way that I could go with this is, you know, we could talk about various strands of anarchism that are, I guess, competing right now or influencing each other, like green anarchism or egoism or nihilism, and the way that that relates to the cultural moment.
I think it's a lot easier to start a flash mob than it is to start a labor union, because it doesn't take very long to people want to have fun. And most flash mobs are able to live, just like you know, like dancing to the high jobs.
So what is it about being apolitical that makes sense right now. So this, would this be like referring to someone like Paul Virilio?
Yeah.
I'm actually not very well versed in that. I tend to think about these things more along the line of what's the hook ideologically, or is, you know, you say consciousness raising. I think about it sort of along the lines of where people's heads are at, not, and whether ideology at all whatsoever is appealing to anybody. And I don't feel like I'm living in a time where it is. There's practical reasons why I think that you were discussing as well.
Like ideologies kind of cement and stagnate, where like people want novelty these days and like want something new. So like things like flash mobs open up these levels.
So one of my ideas about this is that there are real limitations to what is practical and feasible, especially with the housing crisis and the difficulty in establishing not only living spaces but spaces to do counter status quo shit. So I guess, oh, I guess leading off of that is, like, I don't necessarily think people are limited in their desire as much as I think they're... There's just not a lot you could do. But one of the things that I've had the recent experience of is, in Tempe, Arizona, a lot of attempts have been made to function at a neighborhood level and use the existing commercial infrastructure as the space to, as a contested space to exist within. And I've, my experience is that it's worked fairly well as far as, like, there is this police crackdown that was happening every year for a few years called Safe and Sober, and the statistics are comparable to New York Stop and Frisk, where they would have a cop on every corner. They brought in 19 different police departments for one little neighborhood outside of the college there, ASU. And through this sort of association and activity, which a lot of it took place online, that was stopped, along with sit lie laws that were passed and then taken back and some other things. So as I've moved here and experienced more of an urban transitory sort of environment where people kind of move in and out, I've contemplated, like, if that's even possible here. And that's sort of where I start to become really hopeless, because I feel like this is a place that's representative of where my old residence is going. So my concern is, what do you even do in a place like this? And what is even appealing besides a personal ethics about anarchism in an urban environment that's mostly office jobs and is, and consumerism is so tied in with this individualistic social media influenced environment. And I didn't have the fortune of being out here for Occupy Oakland, but it seems like something happened there, right? You had...
No, I was going to ask you about Tempe.
Oh.
What do you think... What do you think your experiences in Tempe do to speak toward the appeal of anarchism as an ideology direction, though? Is what I would wonder.
I don't think as an ideology it does. And I...
But that is the question you're asking, right?
Well, I mean, that's sort of a... I see that as a semantic thing, and that some people try to solve by saying anarchy and not anarchism, but it's like... I don't know. That distinction isn't very deep to me. Like, how long would it be before you had anarchism? So I think there's a real difference between communicating ways of doing shit and ways of thinking. And I think in Tempe what happens is a communication of ways of doing shit. For instance, the environment became so hostile to police that the police were ordered to stop trying to arrest people when you would start yelling at them. So some people took advantage of that by yelling at the police whenever they pulled someone over, and the police would pack up and leave. That's a practice that was communicated through an open hostility to the city and to the police that were taking it over those times of the year.
Together, bring each other, fight each other, fight on the same side, or anything, but just develop develop tactics that work for their positionality and throw it out at anything that provides a similar position can be given a close
Yeah.
I mean, very classic asymmetric conflict theory example.
My biggest concern would be the analysis of context. So what happened in Tempe is very context specific. It's a historical neighborhood with long-term residents that has been traditionally subcultural, countercultural, that drinks a lot and typically just very apolitical, if not anti-political. So one of the things that I think has been helpful in Phoenix and Tempe and in Arizona in general is some of the anarchist media or whatever. One of the blogs is called Down in Drought, and it's a really granular analysis of what's happening in this way with police acquiring new technology, basically what the forces of power are doing at the moment. To try to get a grasp on where the buttons even are that you could push. And I've found it very odd that I don't know of anything like that here.
But you do know about things like that here.
I don't. The one thing I know of is that huge, the Potent Coast essay about how the Bay Area has the most potent coast.
But you have been in rooms where I've heard you talk about people who are reporting on local issues, but I think a lot of the people who have surrounded you have dismissed them as irrelevant. And I wonder if the disconnect that you're poking at is that in Tempe they're maybe still relevant because people know their neighbors and care about those things, but here it's impossible to do that.
Well, that would make sense.
So why? So then what? Is that what you're asking? Then what?
I think, no. I mean, I don't know what that announced. I'm not recalling the memories.
Sure.
So it might be something I would think is useful, or it might not. I mean, I think it would... If it's hyperbolic, or if it doesn't address the lack of, how long people live somewhere, or like that whole situation, then what? How's that helpful? I mean, what I mean is something that defines the context you're in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that you have something like a shared tactical, open source, whatever, but also a defined context to do shit with it.
Doing
until at the Joel Olson Memorial just kind of scoffed at the idea, oh, Beard Revolution is so much cooler. And to me, it's like, well, have your Beard Revolution. Fuck off. Have our Beard Revolution.
That's good. I mean, that's the sort of contextual difference that I think makes a huge difference. But yeah, I don't know. More on, like, to shift the topic a little bit from tactics in themselves or even in context to this sort of appeal aspect of what I'm talking about. So, like, watching this documentary, I think to myself, in what fucking universe would any of these... I realize most people probably haven't seen this, but what the hell would this generation give a shit at all about anarchism? Or about anything about it? I mean, it's such a exceptionally alienated sort of life that... I don't know. So I'm really curious about what it would even look like for, you know, the light generation or the younger people that are alive right now to find something appealing about anarchism. Is the what? I don't. No. I don't.
You know, they have those, like, race flags that you can, like, put over your Facebook profile picture. I mean, you should have an anarchist.
Yeah, just plus it.
Yes. I would do it.
I want to dismiss the ability of younger people's, like, just that younger people's ability to, like, criticize their culture. I don't think that everyone who is a product of a certain time and culture is unable to, like, see that and, like, recognize even if when they are, like, defining themselves and their identity through whatever medium they have accessible to them.
Yeah, I
that every generation can do that, and it's the same with the younger generation. I think that, you know, the appeal of anarchism, it's the same right now as it always has. And my question is, I guess, what's the difference? What would be the difference between the appeal of anarchism and then to now? I feel like now, if anything, like, the anarchism practice versus ideal is, like, more it seems much less attainable, and like you said, like, doing the flash mobs aren't appealing than, like, creating a labor union, because, like, that seems to take so much more time, and people, like, I feel like maybe people of the current generation are so used to, like,
I don't know.
So what? That's actually sort of the thinking I'm doing about this. Is like, what out of the? You don't have to use the three templates that, you know, for convenience I came up with. But out of the three, like mass, group, or more individualistic, what sort of world does that appeal to? And I'm phrasing this as a little awkward, but I mean, it's definitely not appealing to the humanity in every single person that you're ever going to meet, right? As far as I know, that I haven't read a lot of queer anarchist theory that focuses on man. I don't know if there would be some sort of a group like let's form our own commune kind of appeal, or if it's more individualistic, which I'm sort of proposing the idea that that would make more sense right now, is a very personalized individual way of approaching life and the world. I agree. I don't have a whole lot of that. Associating is a weird thing, right? Like, so there's Riot Girl when I was getting into anarchism, and you sort of have your local Riot Girl chapter, right? And this would this would be something that was then networked together, sort of through message boards or mailing each other. That just... associating now on the internet with other anarchists, it's like, you could be really fucking anywhere in the world. And to think about what kind of material support or mutual aid or sort of like accomplice shit you could do together just seems really difficult when really your world of socializing is so huge, which is sort of kind of what you're saying. And yet at the same time individualized.
I think one thing that's changed that's really, like, that's actually like a positive benefit now is that, like, one of the disadvantages that anarchists had to deal with, like, 100 years ago was that the majority of people, when we appealed to them, we had to appeal to them as a worker. So, like, you as a worker, we could, like, we would take the factory together, and then we could run the factory together, and then we could be the factory instead of having someone else make us be the factory. And that was, like, the narrative.
Right.
We can take the field and we can do it together because we're workers. It's like fundamentally what we are. And now, like, I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone in this circle, but I don't really consider myself a worker. And I think most people don't really anymore because we don't identify with our jobs. Like, our jobs are something that
like, not to like sound corny, but I think now it's a lot easier to look beyond that primary division, and instead maybe I could appeal to you as like, I could appeal to you as someone who loves something in common with me, instead of someone that like has the same similar desire to position as a slave in the world.
Yeah, there's a benefit to that. The question I ask when I think about that is, you know, there were anarchists who rejected a worker appeal. Like
that develops.
Yeah. But why was the, I guess, the common, more common discourse about work being a worker, right? So it's not necessarily whether something has existed or hasn't existed. It's, and I'm not, like, from the angle of a person that anarchists would talk to, I found it more appealing that you're talking about my job in the early 1900s. You know. Now I find it more appealing that you're talking about who I'm fucking. Or other parts of my, you know, things that I actually do with my life, because I don't consider myself a worker. I mean, this is not my, so, you know, I don't have a self-image that's consumed in my job, and I don't have a worldview that makes working an achievement of moral good. Maybe.
That would be the crux. That would be my impulse as the crux of the situation. It's like, if we have to appeal to people in a way that they relate to, people will really experience alienation. Like, that's all there is. Those are individual.
So that was sort of what Crime Thinks Old stuff was, right? It was appealing to a drifting kind of lifestyle, except it prioritized more of like a traveler kid sort of lifestyle. But that was still there, right? And that was like, I thought that was a good idea. I kind of lived based off that assumption. But I find it really odd that they decided to go towards to reproduce a mass response to working conditions and precarity and, you know, their recent tours, completely decontextualized from a local drifting kind of thing. But
I wonder if that lack of relevance, you know, like the evasion and all that stuff appealed to like an exciting adventurous romance of like, you can steal something better at this. That's also like that's no longer relevant. I mean, if there is a way to appeal and connect, I almost think it would be from like a brutal recognition and appeal that these people are just surfing in the hellbound, and that's all.
I'm familiar. I like how the abyss keeps coming up.
But it's like the really comfortable abyss. Like, I think what I'm like, it's not like a really wrong thought, but I think like a really big problem with trying to get anything to happen in this current world right now is that I mean, I'm talking again about the first world, which is generally what we're talking about right now. But it's really difficult to have an appeal if the appeal isn't, it's like you're getting less in some ways, you know, like to what people see, because they're like the ultra consumer sort of level. You just walk out the street, go buy anything, do anything you want, you know.
So that, yeah. So that was actually something I didn't mention and that I found really interesting about that documentary is that it did provide examples of what's appealing, and one of those things that's appealing is a persona, right? A personality that, not in the way a rock star used to be very appealing to people, but more in the way that you could be an ordinary person, whatever the fuck that means, and be influenced by what somebody else likes because you are drawn to the character of that person. So there's this one YouTube famous person on there who, I guess they just for a while had video after video of some product they liked, but eventually became so popular that when they would go to a celebrity's event, the fans at the event would celebrate this person going there. So there's some kind of weird dynamic happening around good taste. Some people might call that consumerism, and I like to think of celebrities as model consumers a lot of the time, but it's happening at a more common level. So I think this also ties into the individuality, right? Because we're talking about a single person and their demonstration of what good taste is and people agreeing on that taste. And it's not really a lifestyle. There's no real change in the way anybody's living, but there is a symbolic representation of character and persona. I don't know if it's useful. I think it's I think that it's useful to the extent of comprehending what's appealing to people generally. Whether or not you want to take that and then critique the shit out of it, and that could be a way to be relevant or to counter appeal, you know, in a way that the counterculture counter appealed to the home ownership suburban lifestyle that was offered to them. So in that way, I think that it's important, but I don't think it's motivating to focus on it as an anarchist because it's sort of disgusting. Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah.
that's the fancy stuff. That's like, you know, you're like, oh, like, you know, I didn't just watch the recording, like, I went there. I was really, like, I had a video that verifies that I was there in the authenticity. You know, we see this with, like, you know, any like, niche, it's like spendy consumer trend is usually very authentic. You know, it's like, okay, it's like, you know, I've got songs on my iPod, but, like, if you really have money, you, like, start collecting money. It's like, it's more authentic.
Or food you eat.
Like, they're coming in, they're recognizing the same desires that we're recognizing here.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, yeah, everyone needs authenticity. They're like, yeah, people fucking need that shit.
And it's not, like, that's not to like gain the fact that authenticity or appeal.
Yeah, yeah.
Because capitalism is far reaching, consumerism is far reaching. And if, just because they are capitalizing on that doesn't mean that it's not, like, doesn't have merit. I think there's a difference too between, like emotional authenticity, you know, like something that's very, like, personal.
Again, I don't think that negates it. That's just one thing that's making it something like that.
Can you be appealing and authentic simultaneously? Can you be appealing and authentic simultaneously? To appeal to others is to present yourself in such a way that they would like, which is inauthentic. Right? Wouldn't you say that?
Like marketing, like tries to, like nowadays, especially in the post-social media or in the social media myths, like is trying to be authentic and like showing like people using the products and these real like handheld cam type scenarios, but it's like so. It seems like they're like failing, like or at least. From my perspective, failing, like, blatantly. I don't know who actually buys into that stuff. But they're still buying the products, but...
the time has slipped out the back door, sort of like man has. Hey! thank you for making me not sit here and just talk forever.